Radley Valka is an alumnus of Indiana University at the Journalism School, and he is currently a senior writer for the Huffington Post, where he does investigative reporting on civil liberties and the criminal justice system. He also writes about music and culture in Nashville, where he lives. Previously, Mr. Valka was a senior editor for Reason Magazine, where he wrote award-winning investigative journalism features and weekly columns on civil liberties. He was also a policy analyst for the Cato Institute, covering civil liberties and the drug war. Mr. Valka is here today to speak about his latest book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, and we are so thrilled that he has been so kind enough to join us this evening. So if you all would just join me in welcoming him.
Thank you. Thanks to Young Americans for Liberty for inviting me up here and hosting this event. I've made this joke about four times already, but about 20 years ago, I would regularly fall asleep in this room because I was also a political science major. So I actually had a professor, actually where Brian Cogswell is sitting right there. The professor actually woke me up in the middle of a lecture because I was sleeping. So not that I recommend that, but let's see. I'm going to jump right in with a scary video for you. And I will warn you that this video is pretty disturbing, especially if you're a dog person. So let me set this up real quick for you. This is probably going to be way too loud. This was in Columbia, Missouri in 2011. The police had... Can somebody kill the lights real quick just for the blinker video? So the police had gotten an anonymous tip that there was marijuana or drug activity going on in this house. They did a trash pull, found some traces of marijuana. So they found traces of marijuana, and basically that was all the probable cause they had for what you're about to see in this video. Now, when you watch it, imagine you're asleep in a back bedroom. Imagine sort of what you would have done if this had happened to you. And also, you want to count. I'll move it back just a little bit. Count how many seconds from the time they knock and announce until you hear the first gunshots.
Open police search warrant! Open police search warrant!
So there's the first shot.
Please move and don't move! Please move and don't move! Please move and don't move! Please move and don't move!
I'm going to see an 8-year-old get shuffled out here in a minute.
Move past him. Come on, guys, you're fine. You're fine. Somebody turn around. Don't move. You understand. Put your hands behind your back. Do it now. Behind your back. I'm with you. Let's go.
I got him.
You got him. Good. Hold on. Don't move. You got another injured one. Move. Coming through.
Do not move.
What's injured? What is happening?
Don't move.
God. What is happening?
Search warrant. Narcotic search warrant. Don't move.
In front. I don't care. Pop. Why are you going to be like this?
Columbia
841. What the fuck did I do?
Did you shoot my dog? Did you shoot my fucking dog?
Spare you the rest of that. So, okay. So they did shoot his dog. They shot and killed one dog. They wounded the other unintentionally. They found a small quantity of marijuana in the bedroom, and ironically, this is in Columbia, Missouri. Marijuana had been decriminalized, so it wasn't actually enough to even charge him with a misdemeanor. They did find a pipe near the pot, which, the way the drug laws work, if they had found the pipe anywhere else in the house, it would have been perfectly legal. But because they found it near the marijuana that they couldn't charge him for, they could charge him for the pipe for owning drug paraphernalia. So basically the end result of this was he got a $350 fine, and that was what precipitated this raid. So this raid came out in 2011, and it was... I got a copy of it from the Columbia newspaper. I posted it at the Reason website where I worked at the time. It went viral within a couple weeks. There were a couple million YouTube views of the video. And people were angry by what they saw in the video. I imagine the faces looked a lot like yours do right now. The Columbia Police Department got hate mail. They had to shut down their email and phone lines for a while. They got death threats. And the video kind of circulated all over the country, all over the world, actually. It was even on Fox News. Bill O'Reilly did a segment on the video interviewing noted drug raid expert, apparently, Charles Krauthammer. And Krauthammer said, don't judge the drug war by what you see in this video. These were just rogue cops. This was a rogue incident, isolated incident. This isn't how the drug war actually works. And he was actually 100% wrong on that. This is exactly how the drug war works. In fact, somebody had been covering this for a while. The thing I found fascinating about the reaction to the video is just how angry people were, because there's nothing unusual about what you see in that video. What you just saw happens 100 to 150 times per day in the United States. In fact, the only thing that's really unusual about the video is the fact that it was recorded and the video was released to the public. But everything from the relatively little evidence that they had to conduct the raid, to the fact that it was done at night, the battering ram, the fact that there was a child in the house that they didn't know about, the killing the dog, which is almost perfunctory in these raids, the stray bullets in the house that they weren't careful about. All of that is pretty standard in these raids. I mean, obviously not every raid has all of those elements, but none of those are particularly unusual. So it was almost as if a lot of the country was seeing for the first time, or at least a new generation, the internet generation, was seeing for the first time how the drug war was actually being fought on the ground. And they were angry and repulsed, I think, by what they saw, which, I actually found sort of encouraging. Everything but the death threats, the reaction to the video. I mean, it was that, people did not like this. And this is, again, this is the standard way that drug search warrants are served in this country today. And actually, as I'll get to later, a lot of other warrants. Oh, this is my book. So I'm going to tell another anecdote to sort of start off the night. I tell this story because it really kind of... embodies everything that all the unfortunate trends that I go through in the book and that I'm going to talk about for the rest of the night. So this is Catherine Johnston. She was a 92-year-old woman who lived in a particularly rough area of Atlanta. It was around Thanksgiving week in 2006. Our Atlanta PD narcotics unit was sort of driving around the city. In Catherine Johnston's neighborhood, they saw a guy walking alongside of the road that they had arrested several times on various drug charges. They jumped out on him, threw him to the ground, put a gun to his head, and we would find out later, planted a bag of marijuana on him. They then said to him, you've all seen the TV shows, something to the effect of, you've got a long rap sheet, you know it, we know it, tell us where we can find a large quantity of drugs and we'll let you go. So he just makes up an address, and it happens to be the address of Catherine Johnston. Now, what's supposed to happen at this point is they're supposed to get a confidential informant to do what they call a controlled drug buy. So they put a wire on him, or maybe they give him some marked bills. They send him to the house. He buys the drugs. He comes back with the drugs. Now they have probable cause to get their search warrant. The problem is that whole process could take 2 or 3 days. And this was what was later described as a career-making bust. I mean, it was all phantom and made up, but the informant had told them there was this huge quantity and it was going to make all these cops' careers. So they lied. They invented an informant. They lied about the drug buy on the search warrant affidavit, went to a judge, and a process that's supposed to take a few days took a few hours. The judge, in this case, literally rubber-stamped the search warrant. She had a rubber stamp of her signature that she used for drug warrants because she saw so many of them over the day. Apparently, it took too long to actually sign her name. So within a few hours, they're breaking down Catherine Johnston's door. She had some bars on the outside of her door, so it took them a while. She was sleeping. She had a gun that she kept on her nightstand that actually didn't work, but she would just sort of show it to people to scare them off when, you know, she thought people were trying to break in or were bothering her. So when they finally break open her door, Catherine Johnston is standing in her own living room holding this old rusty revolver. They open fire, and they kill her. They first said that she fired at them. We found out that wasn't true. The gun didn't work. Two officers were wounded by gunfire from their fellow officers. They called 2 ambulances for those 2 cops. They did not call an ambulance for Catherine Johnston. Instead, they handcuffed her and left her to bleed to death on her living room floor while one officer went down to the basement to plant the marijuana that the supply of marijuana that they thought they were going to find. They had a stash in their trunk for, I guess, these sorts of occasions. So now they realize that they have to cover their tracks, right? They're going to have to find an informant who's going to claim to be the informant on the search warrant affidavit. So they go to this guy that they've used several times in the past. And, you know, informants tend to be sort of shady characters. They're usually drug addicts or people who have their own criminal records or trying to get their own charges dropped or reduced in exchange for information. And to his credit, this guy refused to play along. And there's this remarkable 911 call that you can still find the audio online where he calls 911 from the back of an Atlanta police cruiser and sort of naively and charmingly says to the operator, let me talk to the FBI. The operator says, I can't just put you through to the FBI. And he says, well, they're trying to say I helped them kill that old lady, and I don't want any part of that. One of the officers apparently sort of overhears this conversation. He thought he was, you know, in the back seat alone. He suddenly feels like his safety's in jeopardy, so he jumps out of the car and just takes off. The cops start chasing after him. Now you've got this surreal foot chase going on through downtown Atlanta. It goes through the lobby of a hotel. It goes through a couple of businesses. He manages to lose him long enough to find a phone. He was working with the ATF at the time, so he calls his ATF agent, who then swoops in, picks him up, and takes him out to the suburbs. They put him up in a hotel, and now we have a federal investigation. What the federal investigation found was that this was rampant in Atlanta. The lying on the search warrants was going on left and right. The wrong door raids was going on, the cover-ups were going on, and the reason why was because every officer within the Atlanta narcotics unit had a quota. They had to arrest so many people on drug charges each month. They had to seize a minimum quantity of drugs each month, and this was putting immense pressure on these police officers basically to conduct these raids quickly before the drug supply could get moved from house to house. The Atlanta City Council held hearings a few months later. Dozens of people came forward to say that they too had been wrongly raided by one of these Atlanta narcotics units. There was a woman who was 88 years old who lived a few doors down from Catherine Johnston who had actually just been raided a few months earlier. She also kept a toy gun next to her bed to scare people off. They managed to hold their fire in that case. But basically this was an epidemic going on within the Atlanta Police Department. What the federal investigation did not point out, but which I will now point out, is that the reason why these quotas existed in the first place. And that's because the Atlanta Police Department was competing with every other police department in the country for a limited supply of anti-drug fighting money. There are these grants that the federal government gives out. And so your police department is competing with every other police department for a cut of this anti-drug money. There's not nearly as much federal money available for, say, arresting murderers or rapists or armed robbers, but there is a significant quantity of money for arresting drug offenders. And particularly interesting about this money is it's based on raw statistics. So if you arrest a kingpin, let's say you do a 6-month investigation, some of you may have seen The Wire if you haven't, you need to. But say you do a 6-month investigation, and you arrest the kingpin in your city, that's a one when you're applying for one of these grants. If you arrest 20 13 to 15 year old hoppers who are bringing drugs out to motorists in front of the warehouse, how many did I say you arrest? 20. Let's say you arrest 20 of them. That's 20 when you're applying for these grants. So it's about quantity, not quality. So you've all seen in police procedurals where they arrest the mid-level guy and they cut a deal and he gives up everybody above him. The way the federal incentives work, there's actually a strong incentive for you to arrest the middle guy and cut a deal with him to give up everybody below him, because that's going to bring a lot more revenue for the police department than doing it the other way around. So keep this story in mind. I'm going to sort of get into the history now, but these incentives are basically wreaking havoc on the way that law enforcement agencies across the country prioritize the way they fight crime. This puts a much higher priority on drug crimes and everything else. And it also incentivizes them to use more force, SWAT teams in particular, when they are enforcing the drug laws. So this is an old Cold War saying. It's commonly attributed to Winston Churchill, although I can't find any proof he actually said it. But it expresses sort of a sentiment that was common in this country at the time, right? This is how we separate ourselves from Iron Curtain countries, from East Germany or Czechoslovakia. In America, the government doesn't send armed men in black to your house in the middle of the night to enforce political crimes. And I would suggest that not only have we gotten pretty far away from this sentiment over the last 30 or 40 years, even the knocking is now optional a lot with the onset and spread of the no-knock raid. A lot of you may have heard of this term, particularly if you're part of the YAL group, but posse comitatus is... what it actually means and what it's come to mean are two different things. What it's come to mean is this idea, this tradition that we have in the United States of keeping the military separate from domestic policing, right? This goes back to the founding, actually goes back farther than that. The founders actually knew, were students of history, and they knew what happened, for example, in ancient Rome when the world's first police force or centralized police force, the Praetorian Guard, became too powerful and basically became the government of Rome and sort of was one of the reasons why Rome fell. But also they knew their history of Europe, that cultures, free societies that became too militarized didn't remain free for very long. But we also had our own sort of firsthand encounter with this idea of using the military for domestic law enforcement when the British stationed British troops in the streets of Boston in the mid-18th century to enforce import laws and tax laws. And they were armed with these general warrants called writs of assistance. And a writ of assistance basically gave anyone who held it the power to break into somebody's home. They couldn't do it at night, which is actually one thing that makes them better than warrants today. But other than that, they could break into your home at any time, basically whenever they wanted, in order to look for contraband, look for goods that you had that hadn't been taxed or that weren't supposed to be imported. They could keep whatever they seized, and the warrants were so broad, they weren't specific to one home, they weren't even specific to one particular crime. So the holder of one of these warrants could basically break into any house to enforce any of these import or tax laws. And the name, the writ of assistance, meant he could also basically conscript anyone around him to help him enforce these laws. As you might predict, or as you might anticipate, this led to a lot of animosity between Bostonians and the British troops. And this is one reason why Boston became such a hub of revolutionary fervor, because you had these soldiers that could basically break into houses and rifle through your stuff to find anything that could be illegal. They didn't really need probable cause. This also led to a lot of, eventually led to violence between Bostonians and British soldiers, culminating, of course, in the Boston Massacre, which, a lot of historians have argued were sort of the first shots of the American Revolution. But this idea sort of stuck with the founders and the framers of the Constitution, this idea that warrants should be specific to a person or a residence. They should be specific to a crime. And this is why we have the Fourth Amendment today and the specificity requirement of the Fourth Amendment. A warrant expires after it's served. The writs of assistance actually were good from the time they were issued until a year after the death of the king who was in power when they were issued. So the Fourth Amendment basically existed to counter this idea of giving soldiers this much power. But it was also just kind of the militarism that took over, and this idea that you have these agents of the government that are basically trained for war, that are trained to kill people, that were being used for everyday law enforcement. And this struck the founders as a really terrible idea. and sort of experience borne that out. And those experiences in Boston were really kind of fresh in the minds of the framers when they met in Philadelphia to write up the Constitution. Let me go back just a little bit. So this idea that the military and police, domestic police, are two different institutions and have two different, very, very different missions, has really, you know, pervaded, I think, throughout our country's history. And we've actually done a pretty good job of keeping the military out of domestic law enforcement. There have been a few exceptions. Reconstruction is one example where the military was actually came in and was running the governments of the former Confederate states for about a decade after the Civil War. I would argue that was one of the few instances where it was probably justified to have the military doing that. But there have also been a few instances of civil uprisings and riots where the military has been come in to put them down. But as soon as the disturbance was quelled, the military was sort of sent back into active duty in the military and taken off the streets. We've done a pretty good job of this. The one time when we came very close to having the military used for everyday law enforcement was in the mid-80s during the drug war, when the Reagan administration and leaders from both parties actually in Congress wanted to actually bring active duty troops in to start patrolling streets, to do drug searches, to make arrests. And I think this is really a sign of a healthy democracy, that the institution that was most opposed to this idea was the military itself. Now, part of that, I think, is because they realized that, you know, the drug war was a losing proposition and there's no possible way they could have looked good if they were brought in to fight it. But this is testimony from Marine Major General Thomas Olstead, who I think was like the third or fourth guy at the Pentagon at the time. And it was really his testimony in Congress that, you know, put the kibosh to this idea. It was one of the few really terrible ideas about the drug war in the 80s that actually didn't make it into law. And I think the Pentagon's opposition to it is a big reason why. So, as I said, we've done a good job keeping the military out of domestic law enforcement. Where we've dropped the ball, and what basically the book and tonight's talk is about, is what you might call indirect militarization. So we have not turned our soldiers into cops, but what we have done is turn our cops into soldiers. We've armed our cops like soldiers. We've trained them like soldiers. We dress a lot of them like soldiers now. And we send them out on the streets and tell them that they're fighting a war, whether it's war on crime or drugs or terrorism. And, you know, if your opposition to the idea of using the military for domestic law enforcement is that the military mindset is not appropriate for law enforcement, and that would be my argument, right? The military's job is to annihilate a foreign enemy, to kill people and break things. Police officers' job is to protect our rights and keep the peace. But if you take your cops and you teach them all the ways of being a soldier, and you arm them like a soldier, and you tell them they're fighting a war, their approach to the job is not going to be all that different than that of a soldier. And this is, I think, where we're running into problems now. So we're going to play a quick game. This is called Cop or Soldier. I'm going to show you a photo, and you're going to tell me if this is a cop or a soldier. So all these are either photos of active duty U.S. troops in some branch of the military, or these are actually police officers in some police agency in the United States. So these are all U.S. officials of some kind. So here we go. Start.
Cop.
Cop, right.
Soldier.
Cop.
Soldier.
You guys thought you were getting smart. Those are cops.
That has to be soldiers.
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 Cops. It's an Oregon State Trooper. So the camouflage always gets me too. I mean, I guess he actually is in the forested area there. But I mean, you see these SWAT teams wearing camouflage, and I mean, one, they're not really trying to hide from anything anyway. And if they were, they're not, you know, raiding forests, right? They're raiding houses. So really, I mean, the only reason to wear camouflage is to kind of mimic the military, or because you actually got the uniform from the military, which is often the case. So I'm going to give you a little history now. This is a cop, by the way, in case you were wondering. This is Daryl Gates. So there are two kind of trends that start in the mid-60s that get us to where we are today. The first is the rise of the SWAT team, and the second is the rise of the drug war. So let's talk about the SWAT team first. SWAT team started, the idea, I guess, came to Daryl Gates in 1965 during the Watts riots. He was an inspector at the time at LAPD, and he was in charge of LAPD's reaction to the riots, or response to the riots. And Gates was sort of terrified by what happened during the riots. They were unlike any other riots we had seen before. They were not contained to one part of the city. It started in Watts, but they spread everywhere, and they weren't sort of, it wasn't a, you know, a continuous, sort of a contiguous shape that you could draw around the rioters, right? There was a little pocket over here and over here and over here. When firefighters came to try to put out the fires, they were shot at by snipers. And to Gates, this really sort of felt like urban guerrilla warfare, and he did not think that LAPD had an appropriate response to this kind of civil uprising. And of course, this is also a time in American history where it would be reasonable to expect more of these kinds of uprisings. So Gates, because this felt like a war, he started consulting with some Marines at Camp Pendleton nearby and came up with this idea of assembling an elite, highly trained group of police officers who would have a specialty in responding to these emergency sorts of situations. So you'd have, you know, a sniper, you'd have an anti-sniper guy, you'd have somebody who could breach entryways to buildings, you'd have somebody who's an expert in crowd control. And you would put these guys together, and the idea would be that they would use sort of swift, overwhelming force and violence to defuse an already violent situation. So the idea was, you know, you had to come in quickly in order when lives were at risk in order to save lives. The interesting thing is he brings this to Chief William Parker at the time, who's sort of the champion of the professionalism movement in policing. And Parker shoots him down. Parker says that this idea treads too close to this line that we traditionally had in this country, separating the police from the military. And it isn't until Parker dies a year later, Chief Redden takes over, Gates repitches the idea and gets the green light to go ahead with this SWAT team. He came up with the moniker, the SWAT acronym. Originally it stood for Special Weapons Assault Teams. Somebody at LAPD in the communications office told him that you probably shouldn't have the word assault in the name. So they changed it to Special Weapons and Tactics, and the SWAT team was born. The first SWAT raid was in 1969 against a Black Panther holdout in Los Angeles. Logistically, it was pretty much a complete and utter failure. In fact, they were lucky the entire SWAT team didn't get killed. Won't get into the details, but they're in the book. But from a PR standpoint, it was a pretty big success. The Black Panthers were... You know, this is not the sort of phantom menace that Fox News talks about today. In the 1960s, late 60s, the Black Panthers were a violent organization. They actually had a string of bodies to their name by that point. And so a lot of America was afraid of this group. And so they saw, you know, news reports of this kind of valiant team of police officers storming this place and basically apprehending this group that a lot of people were afraid of. They ended up exchanging thousands of rounds of gunfire in the middle of a crowded neighborhood in Los Angeles. Miraculously, no one was killed from either side. But because of and this is fascinating given the way these things turn out today, but because of the way the raid was conducted, that they took the Black Panthers by surprise, the Panthers that they arrested were all tried for attempted murder, for trying to kill the police officers, and the jury acquitted every one of them. They said that because the way the LAPD took them by surprise, it was perfectly reasonable for them to think that they were being attacked and the shots that they fired were in self-defense. Good luck making that argument today during a SWAT raid. The next raid comes in 1973. The Symbionese Liberation Army, which was a domestic terrorist organization. At the time, the SLA had kidnapped Patty Hearst, the newspaper heiress. And this is kind of the tabloid news story of the day. Everybody was following this because everybody, you know, knew who Patty Hearst was. And she had been kidnapped, and then she had been spotted in a security video toting a machine gun during a robbery of a sporting goods store. So basically, you know, the thinking was that she had been brainwashed. That's what she would argue later. So everybody was fascinated as to how this was going to turn out. So when LAPD and FBI thought they had cornered the SLA at this house in Los Angeles, there were national news crews sort of ready to go. In fact, you can still find YouTube videos of reporters sort of ducking under cars as bullets are whizzing by. And again, it was kind of a logistical disaster. Again, thousands of rounds of gunfire are exchanged in a crowded neighborhood. The SLA house ends up burning to the ground, killing everyone inside, including a number of children. But no LAPD officers are killed. Nobody outside the SLA is killed. And again, I mean, this was a group that was even scarier than the Black Panthers for a lot of America, because this group was all about violence. I mean, that's all they were about. And this one was nationally televised. And so now SWAT sort of enters the national pop culture and becomes kind of a phenomenon. In 1970, there was one SWAT team in the entire country. By 1975, there are 500. Basically, every significantly sized city in the country has a SWAT team by the middle of the decade. So a couple years later, Aaron Spelling produces a SWAT TV show, which is this, I highly recommend if you like the fast-talking 1970s cheesy cop shows. It's amazing. Milton Bradley comes out with a SWAT video, or SWAT board game, sorry, SWAT video game comes later. You get SWAT lunchboxes and Viewmaster sets and jigsaw puzzles and little die-cast SWAT mobiles that your son can use to raid his sister's dollhouse. And SWAT really sort of, again, becomes part of the pop culture. So the other thing that, the other trend, as I mentioned, that starts in about the same time is the war on drugs. And this, we really start to see this kind of kick into high gear in 1968. The presidential election, where the Nixon campaign really makes crime the centerpiece of the campaign. And there's this idea of basically, the political strategy was to scare the hell out of middle-class America and make them, embrace Nixon and his sort of tough-on-crime policies. One of the central pieces of the campaign was the no-knock raid. And so this is, the no-knock raid is such a ubiquitous sort of part of law enforcement culture today. One thing I found in researching the book that I found fascinating is that this was not something that sort of naturally evolved out of policing. This wasn't something that police chiefs were demanding or that even criminologists were saying was necessary. The no-knock raid was basically the brainchild of a 28-year-old Senate staffer who had been recruited to the Nixon campaign to come up with issues that Nixon could use, again, to basically scare white people about crime. So this was this tool that's used so often today was, basically had been come up with by this Senate staffer who had no law enforcement experience at all. It was actually the New York State passed the first no-knock raid law a few years earlier under Rockefeller, but that too was basically a political ploy. It was not something that any police personnel were saying they needed. In fact, after it was passed in New York, it was hardly ever used at all. Nixon declares war on drugs in 1970-ish, and then again in 1971. And now the drug war sort of kicks into high gear. 1970, Congress passes two bills with the no-knock raid in them. The first one applies just to Washington, D.C. Of course, the federal government has jurisdiction over Washington, D.C. The other applies to federal narcotics officers doing drug investigations anywhere else in the country. Two very different things happen after those bills are passed. In Washington, D.C., they had a, I would consider, forward-thinking police chief at the time named Jerry Wilson. Jerry Wilson refused to use the no-knock raid. He said it was invasive, it was violative of civil liberties, and it wasn't needed. He said, drug dealers don't go into the drug dealing game to kill police officers. So if they're shooting at police officers as they're breaking into the house, that's probably because they think they're rival drug dealers. But the only other reason you use a no-knock raid is to get in before they can dispose of the drug evidence. And when I interviewed him for the book, he said, look, the idea that we need to break into somebody's home in the middle of the night and put lives at risk in order to preserve a conviction for a quantity of drugs that can be easily disposed of defeats, everything that he thought policing ought to be all about. So he refuses to implement it. Interestingly, crime drops in D.C. over the next 3 years while it goes up in the rest of the country. I don't think not using the no-knock raid is why that happened, but it certainly, did not cause crime to go up in Washington. Across the rest of the country, these federal narcotics officers go nuts. They start kicking down doors left and right. They're raiding houses without warrants. They're raiding the wrong house. They're terrorizing people. People end up getting killed. And these are not SWAT teams. These are basically federal narcotics officers in street clothes. A lot of them are undercover cops, so they sort of look scruffy and they have, long beards and they're wearing kind of raggedy clothes. And they're kicking people's doors down in the middle of the night, and they're often getting the wrong house, and they're not really paying much attention to Fourth Amendment restrictions. The New York Times does an investigation, finds dozens of cases where the wrong houses were raided. The AP does its own investigation, comes up with similar results. Again, there are a few pretty high-profile deaths. And then Congress does something fascinating. They hold hearings. They bring the victims of these raids in to testify. And they actually repeal both laws. So there was actually a time in our country's history where Congress was capable of reflection and shame and was willing to admit that it made a mistake and maybe it had gone too far. Of course, the drug war or the no-knock raid will come back in the 80s. There'll be hundreds of botched raids and a trail of bodies, and nobody in Congress really seems to care. But there was a time when there were at least a few people who did. It's a very optimistic talk, by the way. So throughout the 70s, you get these two trends, but they're moving mostly parallel to one another, right? You got the drug war sort of going and the federal narcotics officers going crazy, and then you've got the rise of the SWAT team. But the SWAT teams are mostly reserved for the emergency types of situations where this kind of force is appropriate. Again, where you're using violence to defuse an already violent situation. So if you think riots, bank robberies, you know, you have a dangerous fugitive on the loose, hostage takings, barricades, terrorist attacks, that sort of thing. And these are cases, again, where you're using violence to defuse an already violent situation, you're using violence to save lives that are at immediate risk, and you're using this kind of force against people who are in the process of committing a violent crime. What happens during the 80s is these two trends then converge, and it's the result of a lot of bad policies, which I'll get into. But the net effect here is now you see SWAT teams and SWAT tactics being used primarily to enforce search warrants on people suspected of drug crimes. And so now you're not using violence to defuse an already violent situation. You're actually creating violence and confrontation where there was none before. You're breaking into people's homes in the middle of the night. These are people who are not in the process of committing a violent act. They're people who are suspected of committing a nonviolent act. And again, you're sort of creating this volatility where it did not exist before. This becomes the primary way SWAT teams are used, still by far and away the primary way they're used today. And this is the result, again, as I said, of a number of policies. So let me get into those real quick. One of the first things Reagan does, he brings the National Guard in to start fighting the drug war. So by 1984, you literally have black helicopters that are swooping in Northern California, Oregon, other states that have sort of large kind of wilderness-type areas and mountain areas where pot can be grown. But the result here, the way these narcotics, DEA officers, National Guard troops, local police officials, basically get free rein to do whatever they want in these towns. And there are towns in Northern California especially that are basically just turned into war zones. They're completely occupied by the DEA and the National Guard. You know, there are stories of families, you know, getting stopped at checkpoints and taken out of the car at gunpoint with no warrant. Homes are getting raided without warrants. Just horrifying tales of these black helicopters getting low enough to the ground to shatter windows, shining spotlights on people at night. It really becomes, again, these places kind of turn into war zones. Reagan also starts a policy that still continues to this day. A lot of them do, but one of them is he instructs the Pentagon to start making surplus military equipment available to police departments across the country. And this is a program that would get expanded in the early 90s, and then in 1997, Congress actually creates an office with a budget solely for the purpose of transferring this equipment. We're talking about tanks, armored personnel carriers, helicopters, military-grade weapons, bayonets. Strangely, police departments love bayonets for some reason. And so this stuff is designed for use on a battlefield, right? This is supposed to be used, again, to annihilate a foreign enemy. It's now being given to domestic police agencies for use on American streets against American citizens. The other thing Reagan does that really has a pretty strong impact is he creates these anti-drug grants. He doesn't really formalize them. They're kind of informal until the first Bush administration when Congress passes a law creating the burn grants after a police officer was killed in New York. Those still exist today. But if you think about this, you're a police chief or a sheriff, right? You get all this cool gear from the Pentagon, so you start a SWAT team because, you know, why not? You've got the stuff. And now you can keep your SWAT team in reserve and wait for one of these emergency sorts of situations, which probably, you know, isn't going to happen all that often in Bloomington, Indiana. Or you can start sending your SWAT team out on drug raids, and every time you send them out and they make an arrest, that comes with some federal money. And now your SWAT team can actually start generating revenue for your police department. You throw in civil asset forfeiture laws, which allow police, which some of you may know about, but under civil asset forfeiture, if the police can make even a loose connection between your property and a drug crime, they can take your stuff, and the proceeds from the stuff, they'll auction it off, or if it's cash, they'll just keep it, goes back to the police department. You, as the property owner, the action in court is actually a civil action, and it's against the property itself. So there's this bizarre legal fiction where the property itself is guilty of the crime. And you, the innocent owner, then have to go to court and prove that you earned that property legitimately. So these cases have names, literally. If you look them up, they have names like, the state of Indiana versus a 1968 Corvette Stingray. Or U.S. federal government versus $58,746. Oftentimes the cost of going to court to win your property back can exceed the value of the property itself. And so this is a great way for police departments to, again, generate revenue. You send your SWAT team out, you seize all this stuff, and you don't even have to ever charge the person with a crime. In fact, most people who lose property through forfeiture are never charged with a crime. So now using your SWAT team, again, becomes a net positive revenue for your police department. And this is why we see a massive explosion in the number and use of SWAT teams, which I'll get to in a second. The other thing we start to see is Reagan really ratchets it up the rhetoric. He takes Nixon's drug war metaphor and, I think his goal was to make the metaphor very literal. At one point, he declares drugs a threat to U.S. national security. He compares the drug war to the World War I Battle of Verdun, which, if you know your European history, Verdun was this battle where the two armies sort of just sat in the trenches and shot at each other for months and months and months. I think there were 750,000 casualties. It was over the strip of land that was had no strategic value to either side. They just kept fighting and dying because neither side wanted to quit, and it was all basically symbolic, which basically means that the metaphor was probably a little more appropriate than even Reagan realized at the time. I have a feeling you're going to object to my characterization of Verdun, but I'll wait till the Q&A if you want to. That it was very appropriate. Okay. Then you have William Bennett, Reagan's education secretary, who goes on to become our first official drug czar. Bennett, one time on Larry King Live, said he actually floated the idea of publicly beheading drug dealers on television. Another point he said, and I'll use the scare quotes that he used, it's a funny sort of war when the enemy gets habeas corpus. So already, floating the idea of indefinite detention for suspected drug dealers. And then you get Daryl Gates himself, who becomes a drug war champion, starts the DARE program, which I went through. I don't know if how many of you went through that, but has proven completely ineffective, but also encourages children to turn in their parents for smoking pot. Gates at one point said that drug users, not dealers, drug users are guilty of treason and should be taken out in the street and shot. This is a position he walked back when his son was caught with drugs. twice, actually. But Gates is also, he later spins off the SWAT video game. Just interestingly, the first version of the SWAT video game, you got points for killing the bad guys, but no points for resolving the situation peacefully. They sort of changed that around in later incarnations of the game. But. And so you see this rhetoric and the martial rhetoric and the garrison rhetoric, and it filters down to the soldiers, or the soldiers, the police officers on the ground. You see sheriffs and captains police chiefs and start using this kind of language. And of course, this still continues today. Just a couple years ago, Michael Bloomberg referred to NYPD as the seventh largest army in the world. Police chief in Milwaukee regularly refers to his police officers as his troops. And you get this rhetoric from police officials all the time. And this is from a sheriff in Clayton County, Georgia from a few years ago. I won't read the quote to you, you can read it yourself, but what I find fascinating about it is, he's not only saying that we need to fight the drug war, as if we're an actual war, but it needs to be a real war, like Normandy, not a namby-pamby war like Vietnam. This guy's talking about his own constituents, right? The people he's supposed to be serving, the people who elected him. It's just sort of, amazing to me. And I'll say this. When the book came out, there's a website called Police One. It's kind of the central hub of police camaraderie and activity on the internet. And they commissioned a series of essays in response to my book, which I guess was flattering in its own strange way. But one of the criticisms that I've gotten from police groups in general was that I'm exaggerating this mentality aspect, that cops approach their jobs as soldiers do, or that they have a battlefield mentality. And one of the essays that were included in this group was written by this SWAT leader, SWAT commander in Sterling Heights, Michigan. And the argument that he makes in his essay is basically, you're damn right I'm a soldier, and you're damn right my neighborhood is a battlefield. At one point he says that being a police officer today is just as dangerous as being an active duty soldier in Afghanistan, which is absurd. I mean, the numbers aren't even close. But I mean, here's a guy who was saying not only that, you know, I wasn't wrong about that, he's saying, of course, we should embrace it. Of course police officers are soldiers, and we face this every day. Face war every day and potential threats every day. In reality, the job of police officers has been getting safer since the mid-1990s. In fact, you're more likely to be murdered today just living in a city like Chicago, Atlanta, Nashville, where I live, than you are being a active duty police officer. It's still it's more dangerous than being a journalist, for example, or a student, but it's not nearly as dangerous as it used to be, and it's not nearly as dangerous as it's portrayed to be. And I think the problem with that is we're constantly telling police officers every day how dangerous their job is and how every interaction with a citizen could be their last. And when you continually tell them that, even when it's not true, they are eventually going to internalize it, and they're going to start treating every citizen as if they are a potential threat. And again, this is a battlefield mentality. This is not the mentality of somebody who is serving the citizenry or who's protecting and serving. It's the mentality of somebody who, and this is a phrase you often see on these police websites, it's not about protecting and serving. The phrase you'll see over and over again is, whatever I have to do to get home at night. Right? And that, again, is kind of a soldier approach to a soldier's job, not the approach of a police officer. By the way, Sterling Heights, Michigan, where that SWAT commander served. In 2011, it was named the safest city in Michigan. It's had 8 murders over the last 10 years. So this is the town that this particular police officer sees as a battlefield that's constantly a threat to his safety. So you get these policies from the Reagan administration, and what you see is this explosion in both the number and use of SWAT teams. There's a professor at University of Eastern Kentucky University, who in the late 90s sent surveys out to police departments across the country and asked them to go back to the late 70s, tell them what year they started their SWAT team, and then tell them how many times the SWAT team was deployed each year and for what reason. So here's what he found. In the late 1970s, there were about 300 SWAT raids per year across the entire country. Right? So if you think about it, that kind of makes sense, right? If you're waiting for those emergency-type situations where that sort of force is appropriate, that seems like a fairly reasonable number. By the early 80s, we're up to about 3,000 SWAT raids per year. By 2005, when he does a follow-up study, we're looking at 50,000 SWAT raids per year. He estimates we're somewhere between 80 and 100,000 today, although he hasn't done another survey, but the trend sort of, if you look at the trend line. So from a few hundred per year to approximately 80 to 100,000 per year today. And what he found is about 80% of SWAT raids, when he did a study anyway, were to serve search warrants on people suspected of drug crimes, and the majority of those were for marijuana. Another stat he found that still kind of blows me away, 1981, if you look at towns between 25,000 and 50,000 people, about 13% of them had a SWAT team. By 2000, 80% of them had a SWAT team. And it's probably reasonable to assume just about all of them do today, again, because the trends, you know, everything that was driving that trend has continued. So just a couple quick anecdotes. This is Sheriff Leon Lott from Richland County, South Carolina, and this is his tank. He got this from the Pentagon. As you can see, it has a fully 360-degree rotating gun turret that shoots belt-fed ammunition. It's a machine gun. Shoots 50 caliber belt-fed ammunition. Now, the military has restrictions on when it uses 50 caliber ammunition. If you fire a 50 caliber gun in the city, it'll go through about 10 blocks no matter what's standing in the way. If there's nothing standing in the way, it'll go a lot farther. But completely inappropriate for domestic policing, especially in a county like Richland, which is home to the University of South Carolina. Sheriff Lott put out this picture with a press release. He was so proud of his tank, he put out a press release. He named it the Peacemaker. And at the top of the press release, he put the Bible quote, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God." To give you an idea of in what sorts of situations Sheriff Lott thinks this kind of force is appropriate, you may remember a few years ago, the Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps was photographed smoking pot at a University of South Carolina party. Well, that's Sheriff Lott's jurisdiction. He took it personal, took very personal offense to the fact that this happened under his watch. And so he basically made it his mission to find whoever supplied the pot that Michael Phelps was smoking in that picture. So there's actually a lawsuit pending against him right now. And the description, and of course this is only half of the lawsuit, so take that into consideration. But the description of what happened, basically the lawsuit was filed by people who appeared in the photo, the same photo where Michael Phelps was smoking pot. And so Sheriff Lott sent his SWAT team after them. So these people woke up in the middle of the night to flash grenades, people breaking into the homes. They were thrown out of their beds at gunpoint. And the cops were screaming at them, not where are the drugs, where are the guns, but what do you know about Michael Phelps? Which is amusing and kind of terrifying, right? These are just more photos of... These are all domestic police agencies in the U.S. and their tanks and other gear. You may have read about this story, this Steven Seagal, action hero. So Seagal is an aspiring police officer. He was deputized by a sheriff's department in Louisiana several years ago for the reality show Steven Seagal Lawman. He had to resign after some unfortunate sexual harassment allegations. But Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the self-proclaimed toughest sheriff in America, then deputizes him himself and invites the reality show to follow Seagal along. And so Arpaio also has a tank that he got through the Pentagon, also shoots 50 caliber ammunition, and he sends Seagal out on a raid with the TV cameras. The raid was on this poor guy who was suspected of cockfighting, so raising chickens to fight other chickens. And for that crime, Steven Seagal drove his tank into the guy's living room, literally drove it into his living room. They killed all of his, euthanized all the chickens, they killed two of his dogs. When Seagal was asked why he thought that level of force was appropriate, he said, because I'm an animal lover. There's a lawsuit going on in that case, too. Again, with the camouflage. I actually showed this photo. This is pretty common. Actually, I just wrote a story for Huffington Post last week about a raid where these DEA agents had face masks on. They raided these two ladies and clearly had the wrong house, but would not tell them their identities. And that was 7 years ago, and the women are still trying to find out the actual names of the DEA agents who raided them. But this covering up of the face thing, I mean, there's no strategic value to it. It's about scaring the hell out of people, basically, and possibly protecting the identities of the agents in case they do something wrong. But I bring this up because a couple years ago, I remember there's a conservative commentator named Michael Ledeen who was agitating for war with Iran. And he wrote on the blog and this website, Pajamas Media, there were a few, a series of Reuters photos that had come out of Iran during there was a drug raid in Tehran. And in the photos, you see these Iranian government agents doing this drug raid, and their faces are all covered up, only you can only see their eyes. And I remember being amused because I've been writing about this particular issue for a while, where Ledeen writes on this site, basically, you know, trying to get us angry at Iran. You know you're living in a totalitarian state when the law enforcement officers cover up their faces. And of course, I've been writing about this long enough to know that this is pretty standard practice in a lot of drug raids in the United States. Ledeen apparently was not aware of that. Or maybe he thinks we live in a totalitarian state. I don't know. This is a SWAT team at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. So the campus actually has its own SWAT team. Actually, that may be the case here, too. I'm not sure. But we're seeing this more and more. Ohio State just bought an MRAP, which is stands for mobile. Basically, it's a military vehicle that is landmine resistant. Ohio State just bought one of those from the military. But we're seeing this more and more, SWAT teams on college campuses. And the justification is always, you know, Virginia Tech and Columbine. There's a sociologist at the University of Virginia who's actually crunched the numbers and found that the average middle school, high school, or college campus can expect to see a homicide about once every 6,000 or 7,000 years. So the idea that every campus needs a SWAT team in order to prevent another Virginia Tech is absurd. The problem is, once the SWAT team is in place, most college campuses obviously have more than enough pot smoking and dealing to keep the SWAT team busy once they're up and running. But this is standard. We always hear, even in small towns, the excuse is always we have to prevent school shootings and so forth. And then once they get the SWAT team, the primary use of them is again for drug raids. So this is a map we did when I wrote a paper on this issue for the Cato Institute. Each one of these thumbtacks, the other one, you can see the other one includes a lot more categories. But each one, I think this one's particularly compelling. Each one of these is a case where a completely innocent person was killed during one of these raids. So this is not a drug dealer. This is not even a pot smoker or drug user. These are cases where cops got the wrong house completely and someone died as a result. And I've counted, I think we're up over 50 of these now that I've been able to find, although I keep finding them from 10 or 20 years ago that weren't documented at the time. All right. So there are two sort of points, I guess, over the last 20 years or so where I think we really kind of enter new territory with this issue. The first comes in 1996 when California legalizes medical marijuana. Up until this point, the justification for this kind of force for drug raids from governments and law enforcement officials was always, well, drug dealers are really dangerous people, they're really heavily armed, they wouldn't think twice before killing a bunch of cops. And there are rebuttals to all of those arguments, and I get to them in the book. But at least the government was making the argument, right? They were saying, we are facing this level of force, therefore, or this level of a threat, therefore we have to use this level of force in response to that threat. The force is proportional to the threat. California legalized medical marijuana, and several states then follow suit. The Clinton administration responds by sending federal SWAT teams in to raid these medical marijuana dispensaries. At this point, you can no longer argue this proportional threat argument, right? The hippie mom-and-pop couple that are running the pot dispensary are not a threat to pull an AR-15 out from under the counter and kill a bunch of federal agents. These are businesses. They're all openly operating. They're not criminal enterprises. Most of them have business licenses. They're operating under state law, but they are openly flouting federal law, and this is why we see this level of force. And, a lot of people protested the raids at the time, but I don't think this particular point was all that well expressed or appreciated, and that is that the government was using violence to make a political statement. They were making examples of people with violence. And this is not the sort of thing that we normally, or should, I would argue, associate with a free society or the principles of a free society. And of course, this goes on still today. In fact, there have been more medical marijuana raids in 4 years of Obama than there were in 8 under Bush, so it's actually only getting worse. You may have read in the last few years these raids on co-ops and Amish farms that are selling unpasteurized milk. And they're selling it to people who want to buy unpasteurized milk. These are voluntary transactions. But the FDA prohibits the sale of unpasteurized milk and cheese. And so these Amish farms and co-ops are openly flouting federal law. Again, in some cases they've been warned a couple times. So the government's responding by sending SWAT teams in to raid them. Again, your average Amish farm probably isn't a threat to kill a bunch of federal law enforcement officials. But, again, they're openly flouting federal law, so we use violence to make an example of them so that the other Amish farms and co-ops will comply. So this is the other, point where we start entering scary new territory. And this is probably the last 5 or 6 years I've noticed this happening. So now we're increasingly seeing SWAT get mission creep, right? These SWAT teams are either getting bored with the drug war or, in some states, drug, particularly pot, is becoming a lower priority for police departments, so they're finding new ways to use their SWAT team. And so we're seeing them used in the mid-2000s, you might remember, sort of the Texas Hold'em poker craze takes off. A lot of towns respond by sending SWAT teams in to raid these neighborhood poker games. We're talking $20, $30, $100 buy-ins. In some cases, they were raiding bars that were openly advertising poker tournaments. These are highly volatile situations. These are dangerous tactics. And you've got, people in some states openly carry, right? And so you've got these armed men that are breaking into these poker games very violently. And there have been cases that they've been resulted in gunfights with people who had no prior criminal record and were not trying to kill cops, who legitimately thought they were being robbed. Of course, that's not, they end up getting criminally charged anyway. But then we see really things start to get really ridiculous probably in the last 5 or 6 years. We're now seeing SWAT teams used to enforce regulatory law, right? Not even criminal law anymore. And one way they do this, one reason they do this, is to get around search warrant requirements. I wrote about a case in Manassas Park, Virginia, a suburb of D.C., a far suburb of D.C. There was this bar, it was a pool hall, where the police thought there was drug activity going on. But they couldn't get enough evidence to get a search warrant, which really means they couldn't get any evidence at all. So what they did is they called up the State Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and the Virginia ABC sends an inspector along, and now this is officially an alcohol inspection. They serve it with a 50-member SWAT team that comes in and handcuffs people and searches them and puts guns to their heads. But officially, they were there to make sure all the beer was properly labeled, that the specials were properly advertised. They ended up arresting 5 people. Three of them were informants working for one of the police agencies involved. 2 of them were undercover cops who were working for another police agency involved. And two of the undercover informants actually sold drugs to 2 of the undercover cops. The owner of the bar, the guy who they were basically after, they wrote him up on 2 infractions. One was he had gotten a bottle of beer from a beer wholesaler that was not properly labeled as a sample. And second, he had a personal office that was sort of on the site, and he had a bottle of vodka in his desk, and they wrote him up for that as well. The amazing thing is he filed suit, and the Federal Court of Appeals, which Virginia, help me out, Steve, what district is that? 10th, maybe? No, 6th. Yeah, so we'll just say 6th. So the 6th Circuit Federal Court of Appeals actually ruled that using a SWAT team to perform a regulatory alcohol inspection is not unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, right? So basically using a SWAT team to make sure your beer is properly labeled, according to this federal appeals court, is perfectly reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And you got to wonder what sort of force is unreasonable, right, at this point. To be fair, there's another circuit that actually has ruled, there was another case like this, the circuit with Louisiana in it, which I still don't know. But that circuit actually ruled that it is unreasonable to use a SWAT team to perform an alcohol regulatory inspection, which I guess is great, but there's a split, right? The fact that there's a split over this issue tells you just how absurd things have become. So this is in Orlando, the slide here. And again, this is police suspected there was drug activity going on in these barbershops across the city, mostly minority-owned. Again, they could not collect enough evidence to actually get a search warrant, so they called up the State Occupational Licensing Board, who then sent an inspector along, and these raids on barbershops were officially licensure inspections to make sure all of the barbers in the barbershop were properly licensed to cut hair. They arrested 37 people. 34 of them were arrested for barbering without a license, which only one person had ever been arrested for before in the state of Florida. They found two drugs on 2 people, charged them with misdemeanors. They found one guy in all of the raids. I think there were about 24 raids over 3 months. Who they found enough drugs to actually charge him with a felony. NASA has its own SWAT team. This is a story. There's a woman who whose husband claimed that Neil Armstrong gave her this little piece of moon dust. And after her husband died, she tried to auction it off, I think on eBay or something. And I guess that's against federal law. You can't, anything that comes from space, you're not allowed to sell. So they respond by sending the NASA SWAT team to arrest her at a Denny's. So this story came out in, 2011. So the Department of Education raided this guy in California. It was initially reported that he had been raided because his wife hadn't been behind on her student loan payments. The Department of Education issued this very offended press release saying, of course that's not why we did this raid. She was raided because she was suspected of lying on her student loan applications and defrauding the student loan program, which raises the question of why does the Department of Education have a SWAT team in the first place, and even that is not an appropriate use. Interestingly, there's a sort of an addendum to the story. So in my book came out, I wrote an essay in the Wall Street Journal that sort of went with the book. And I mentioned this particular raid, and the Department of Education, again, was offended, and they demanded a correction, which, to my dismay, the Wall Street Journal editors gave them. But the Department of Education said, we don't have a SWAT team. We have a team of armed law enforcement personnel who serve high-risk search warrants with shotguns and a battering ram by serving warrants first thing in the morning, in this case, by taking down the guy's door. But we don't call it a SWAT team, therefore we demand a correction. And the reason why they don't call it a SWAT team is because they said they don't get any tactical training. So the Department of Education's defense here and why they're demanding a correction is that, yes, they have a armed team of law enforcement personnel that does everything that most SWAT teams do, but they're not as well trained as a SWAT team, therefore they're demanding a correction, which gives you a little bit of an insight into the mentality of how these law enforcement teams are being used. By the way, there are 73 federal agencies now that have their own armed law enforcement personnel. I wish I could tell you how many of those actually have SWAT teams, but again, this apparently is a term of art now. But it's safe to say that most of them do have the power to execute these kinds of search warrants. All right, I'll tell you the story real quick. This is Sal Colosi. He was a 38-year-old optometrist in Fairfax County, Virginia. Colosi was at a TGI Fridays, I think, Ruby Tuesday, one of those. And he was in the bar section, and he was wagering on a Virginia Tech game with some of his friends. There happened to be an undercover vice cop from the Fairfax County Police Department also there who overheard the conversation. The vice cop befriends Colosi and some of his friends and starts wagering with them himself. Over the next 3 or 4 months, he continues to wager with Colosi, eventually talks Colosi into wagering more than $2,000 on a single game. Now, Colosi was a bachelor optometrist, very well-to-do. You know, he may have had a gambling problem, for all I know. But he did not want to wager this much necessarily, but this cop continued to talk him up. $2,000 was enough to trigger the Virginia statute for running a gambling operation. So now they're going to charge him with this felony of running a gambling operation. Now, I sort of think we're already sort of well past the bullshit point at this point in the story, but then they decide to arrest him by sending the SWAT team. So Colosi gets a call from this guy who thinks he's a friend who's going to come to collect his winnings. They send the SWAT team instead. The guy calls. Colosi comes out of the porch. He's barefoot, pair of jeans. He reaches into his pocket to pull out a cell phone. SWAT team converges. One of the SWAT officers shoots him right square in the heart and kills him. Now, the police version of the story is that the SWAT officer got out of the SUV, the door recoiled, hit him in the elbow, which caused him to mistakenly fire his gun, scoring a hit directly to Colosi's heart. Colosi's family, and I find this much more plausible, says they think that the cop mistook the cell phone for a gun and shot him intentionally. The officer himself was suspended for 2 weeks without pay, which the police union called unconscionable. The Fairfax County Police Department initially said they serve all their search warrants with the SWAT team. They didn't back down a little bit after that. A couple months later, this was in January 2006, a couple months later, the NCAA tournament starting to kick up. Fairfax County Police Department, and I don't think they meant it this way, but it was clearly tone deaf, they sent out a press release all across the county warning people not to participate in office NCAA pools. And the headline at the top of the press release was, office gambling, you can't handle the risk, right? And this, of course, is 2 months after they had killed a guy for basically wagering on a college football game. Incidentally, state of Virginia spent $20 million marketing its state lottery that year also. I'm going to skip through these real quick. I'm going to have to buy the book to read the Shaquille O'Neal story, sorry. These are some Tibetan monks who were in the U.S. on a peace mission. They overstayed their visas, so naturally you send the SWAT team after them. All right, so I'm going to get into this real quick. So one more kind of milestone moment that I want to talk about, and this is September 11th. So after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, you may remember the following Super Bowl, the federal government puts out these commercials basically saying that people who smoke pot are supporting terrorists. A really kind of shameless attempt to exploit fear of terrorism and sort of channel that into support for the drug war. What then happens in 2003, we get the Department of Homeland Security, and since 2003, the Department of Homeland Security has been getting grants to police departments across the country to buy more, yet more military equipment. And the difference between these DHS grants and the Pentagon giveaway, well, one, the DHS grants just dwarf the Pentagon program. It's DHS has given away about $35 billion. The Pentagon, I think, gave away most it's ever given away in a year is $500 million. But the main difference is that these DHS grants are going to buy brand new equipment, right? So the Pentagon stuff, you know, that already existed. It was surplus. It was sitting in a warehouse somewhere. When you're giving these grants away to buy new equipment, are now giving rise to a cottage industry that has sprung up solely to build this equipment in exchange for these checks from DHS. I would be surprised if it hasn't happened already, but if it hasn't, it will. This industry, of course, is going to open its lobbying shops in Washington, D.C. To make sure that these programs continue and expand, and now you can say hello to the police industrial state, the little brother of the military industrial state, or complex, sorry. I'm going to show you another video real quick. There's a town in New Hampshire, Keene, New Hampshire, that actually tried to oppose this. There's a company called Lenco that makes these Bearcats, which are these armored personnel carriers. This is the most popular item bought with these DHS checks. They cost anywhere between $300,000 and $500,000. But they're these big, you know, armored tanks, basically, although they don't have, some of them have guns, some of them don't, but they're armored personnel carriers. And they're going to places like Fargo, North Dakota, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and of course, when you know Tuscaloosa inevitably does not succumb to Al Qaeda, the Bearcat then gets used for much more mundane policing, mostly to serve drug warrants. But I wrote an article about Keene, New Hampshire, because Keene has been infiltrated by a bunch of libertarians in this Free State Project, and they actually opposed the Bearcat, and they basically tried to, when the city council was going to vote on it, they protested and basically tried to get the city council to turn it down. And I wrote an article about it, and I interviewed a spokesman for the Lenco company, which makes the Bearcat. And, you know, he was very slick, and he talked about how, you know, this is, anybody who opposes a Bearcat is just doesn't care about the lives of police officers. And he said, you're much more likely to, when a Bearcat pulls up, it's much more likely to be filled with a team of psychiatrists than it is a team of cops. Basically saying the idea here is you send in the armored, you know, vehicle when you have a hostage situation and you're there with negotiators who are going to talk the person down, and like this is how the Bearcat is primarily used. So I'm going to show you the video that the Lenco company uses to market the Bearcat to police departments across the country. Maybe. Some awesome, awesome, unsubtle phallic imagery coming here. There it is. So you get the idea. So there must be another video where it's filled with psychiatrists. I don't know, but you can get that's not how they're marketing it, right? It's all about kicking ass and taking names. And this is, you know, and this is again, this is the image that police departments are trying to project. The If you Google, you can go to Google and you can look up police recruitment video. And you'll see the videos that police departments across the country send to high schools and colleges to recruit new police officers. And they're disturbing. I mean, they're about cops rappelling out of helicopters, guitars blaring, sicking dogs on people, firing guns. I mean, again, it's all, there's no sort of emphasis on community service. It's all about, again, kicking ass. And I mean, if you think about the people you went to high school with, and think about who would watch a video like that and think, yeah, that's what I want to do for a living. I can think back to that, and those are the last people that I want to be giving a gun and a badge to. But that's really sort of who they're appealing to, and that's the very first step in the process, right? The last area of the narrative sort of in the book is protest, and I'll just go through this very quickly. But protest has followed sort of the same path that we've seen in these other narratives, which is that the default position, the default response to protest in the United States now is overwhelming force, the cops coming out in full robo gear. And you can trace this back to 1999 with the WTO protests in Seattle. And I actually interviewed the police chief in Seattle for the book, and he was in charge of the response. He defended at the time, and actually for several years after, defended the response. And he had this sort of moment of clarity during the Occupy protests when he saw the images of the UC Davis where the cops were spraying down the protesters like he was watering his flowers. And Norm Stamper, the police chief, said he had this moment where it suddenly struck him that his response to protests in Seattle has become the template. And he said it actually broke his heart. He said it was the biggest mistake of his career. And this is, I mean, when you think about it, the way we respond to protests now, the more important the meeting or conference, the more consequential the decisions being made, the more influential the people making those decisions, the less likely it is that the protesters are going to be allowed anywhere near those people, right? And that's the very opposite of what the First Amendment is supposed to be all about, right? But now if it's a national party convention or if it's a WTO or G20, you're more likely to have these free speech zones, which are put as far away from the actual decision makers as humanly possible. I just want to show you one. This is a T-shirt that the Denver Police Union had made up before I think it was the DNC in 2008. So they had printed these shirts up and they were actually selling them to the public until somebody made a big deal about it, and then they apologized, but here it is. Can you read that? It says, it's a cop holding a big baton, and he's looking over the city of Denver, and it says, "We get up early to beat the crowds." I mean, it's one thing for cops to make a joke like that to each other, over beers after work. This is the image they were projecting to the public. I mean, they were advertising this idea. And of course, it's a joke, but it's also not a particularly funny one. All right. So I'm going to close with this story. So Corey May was, at the time this happened, was 21 years old. He and his girlfriend had just moved into a duplex in Prentice, Mississippi, basically to make a life together with their 18-month-old daughter. Prentice is in Jefferson Davis County. This is a part of Mississippi that's sort of, unfortunately, race is kind of a suffocating part of everyday life, so mostly segregated. But they moved into this duplex. Corey's girlfriend, Gentile Longino, worked at a chicken processing plant. She worked the night shift. So when all this happened, Corey was asleep with his 18-month-old daughter. So this is the day after Christmas 2001. Earlier that day, Ron Jones, a police officer with the Prentice Police Department, also happened to be the son of the town police chief, got a tip from an informant that there was drug activity going on in the duplex on Mary Street. Now, the guy who lived on the other side of the duplex was named Jamie Smith. He was a known drug dealer. In fact, he had drug charges pending against him when all this happened. The informant that gave Jones the tip was described on the warrant as trustworthy and reliable. And in fact, he was used in dozens of drug investigations, always described that way. We'd find out later that he was a drug addict and also an unapologetic racist. In fact, when Corey's defense team found him, he left this rambling, it was about a 90-second message on one of the answering machines of the attorneys that drops the N-bomb about 12 or 13 times over 90 seconds. But again, so this guy was, to give you an idea of how these drug investigations work, this guy was described as trustworthy and reliable, clearly was neither. In any case, the police do their raid. So Jones gets a raid team together. They had a narcotics task force in the area, but it was the day after Christmas. A lot of them were off. So Jones sort of assembles this ad hoc SWAT team. They raid Jamie Smith's side of their duplex about 12:25 in the morning. Smith, who probably had good reason to think that the people banging on his door were cops, let them in. He's arrested without incident. Corey's asleep. He wakes up to the sound of people trying to break into his house. He moves to the back, gets a gun that he had owned legally out of his nightstand, lays down on the floor, clutching the gun next to his daughter, sort of hoping the noises will go away. They don't. They move around to the back, and within a few minutes, the door flies open, and a figure dressed all in black ascends the three-step climb into Corey's apartment. Corey fires his gun three times. Ron Jones was wearing a bulletproof vest, but one of the bullets got under the vest, pierced his abdomen, and he bled out and died on the way to the hospital. Corey fired three shots from his gun and then surrendered. They arrested him. Actually, they first beat him pretty severely, then they arrested him and charged him with capital murder, basically the intentional killing of a police officer. Corey had no prior criminal record. He did have a roach in a house, which would have gotten a $50 fine under any other circumstances. But 3 years later, he was convicted and sentenced to death. So I found this case when I was researching the paper I wrote on this issue for Cato. I'd studied enough about these raids at this point and reported on enough of them to recognize when something was wrong. The AP had covered this. The New York Times had even covered this on page one, although in a completely different context. And nobody had sort of picked up on the idea of why a guy with no prior criminal record would knowingly take on a team of raiding police officers with a handgun and then kill one of them and then immediately surrender with bullets still left in the gun. To me, the most obvious explanation is that he didn't know they were cops. The state's contention was that he did know they were cops and he did intentionally kill one of them and surrendered for some reason with bullets still left in the gun. To me, Corey's story seemed much more plausible. So I started writing about the case. Got picked up on the blogs. There was an associate at Covington & Burling, a big law firm in D.C., who had a daughter that was about Corey's age, kind of empathized with Corey, thought about what he would have done in that position, and decided to bring the law firm on board to represent Corey. They hired their own investigators. We later found out, and I've been writing a bunch about this too, they used this corrupt medical examiner to testify in his case, who gave some testimony that was basically bullshit. There was no scientific evidence to back it up, but it did cast doubt on Corey's story and made him lose credibility with the jury. In any case, I won't bore you with the whole procedural details, but basically about 6 months later, Corey's death sentence gets tossed out. The judge resentences him to life without parole. About, I think it was 2009 or 2010, the Mississippi Supreme Court gave him a new trial. At his original trial, he was not allowed to argue that he was defending his daughter's life that night. The Mississippi Supreme Court said he should have been allowed to argue that, so they gave him a new trial. He also had a really terrible attorney. The public defender, actually, that he would have had is good, but his family didn't want a public defender. They didn't trust them, which in a lot of cases is probably the right reaction. But they ended up hiring this private attorney who had no idea what she was doing. I think she had watched too many TV shows. She immediately moved for a change of venue. Well, the shooting happened in Jefferson Davis County, which is about 70% black. She ended up moving it to Columbus, Mississippi, which is in a county, I can't remember the name of the county, but it's about 80% white. Completely different demographics politically. It was a huge mistake on her part. But the Mississippi Supreme Court, when they granted him the new trial, they also said that the new trial should be in Jefferson Davis County, where it should have been all along. So the prosecutors realize that the best they're going to get in this county is a hung jury. By now, the case, is well known in the area. It's divided down racial lines. The jury is obviously going to be racially divided. So in 2011, the prosecution offers Corey a deal. They say, we'll let you plead guilty. If you plead guilty to voluntary manslaughter, which is a felony, we'll let you off with time served, which means he would get out. By that time, he'd served 10 years in prison. He didn't want to admit to something he didn't do. It was clearly an accident. I mean, he admitted he made a mistake and shot the cop, but it was not intentional. But he wanted to see his family. He wanted to be back in his kid's life. Corey was also a doting father. This is part of the country where a lot of kids don't have fathers. Corey was, by all accounts, a great father. In fact, the mother of the woman he knocked up out of wedlock testified as a character witness at his trial to give you an idea of sort of how devoted he was to his kids. So he gets out, he pleads the felony, and I remember we were at the homecoming party, and there's this big kind of soul food buffet, and Corey's taking cousins and his kids out for rides on four-wheelers, and he's bonding with his daughter and sort of getting to know his kids all over again. And everyone was happy and joyous and everybody smiling. But toward the end of the evening, one of his attorneys and I were talking, and it sort of occurred to us just how completely screwed up it was that everybody was happy. I mean, it's understandable, but I mean, here's a guy who wasn't doing anything wrong. He was woken up in the middle of the night to basically armed state agents breaking into his house. Was put in this unimaginable position of having to decide if they were there to kill him and his daughter or rob them or, you know, for some reason, police serving a warrant, which he wouldn't have thought because he hadn't done anything wrong. Made a mistake, same sort of mistake that cops had made dozens of times in these raids, by the way, and are never held accountable for. And for that, you know, he gets beaten, arrested, taken out of his kid's life for the next 10 years. His girlfriend sort of moved on, got remarried, tried to pull his daughter sort of out of his life, understandably. I mean, he's on death row. State tries to kill him for 4 years. They then transfer him to the most notoriously violent section of one of the most violent prisons of the country, Parchman Penitentiary. You know, they use this corrupt medical examiner to help convict him. And, you know, at the end of all this, they graciously let him plead to a felony, which, of course, is going to follow him around for the rest of his life. He can't vote. He can't, you know, ever buy a gun again. Every time he applies for a job, he's going to have to note that he's a convicted felon. And, you know, this is one of the happy stories, right? We're joyous about this. You know, in a just world, I would think we would be out sort of with signs picketing out inside in front of the courthouse and, you know, demanding the police officer did this be arrested and charged. Instead, we're happy. And it sort of occurred to us that the fact that we're joyous shows just how low our expectations have become at this point and sort of how far we've come on this issue where this, you know, this could be one of the happy endings. I write in the book that, you know, I think the term police state is way overused. If we were actually in a police state, I would have been arrested for writing this book, and you would all be arrested for being here. But for people like Katherine Johnston or Sal Colosi or Corey May, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that there is kind of a police state writ small, you might say. If you have a bad interaction with a police officer, the deck is stacked against you. I mean, the officer's word, if it's the officer's word against yours or his word against several you and several witnesses, you're not going to win in court. If a police officer does something wrong to you, he's probably going to get away with it. If you make a mistake in judgment, you're not going to get away with that. So I think you can make a pretty good argument that if, for example, you're a black person living in a part of New York that's under stop and frisk, and, you know, every third or fourth time you leave your house, you're going to be stopped and frisked. There's an argument to be made that you live in a police state. So we may not, you know, be in an East German-type police state yet. But, you know, I would argue that it would be a mistake for us to wait until we get to one to be concerned, because by then, of course, it would be too late. So thank you for inviting me out, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Can you shed any light on exactly how cops get away with this kind of stuff?
The question is, how do cops get away with this stuff? Well, for one, I mean, there's kind of this heroic portraiture of cops that we face. And I always get this argument. I'm a libertarian. I get this argument with conservatives all the time. Conservatives understand that they understand sort of the trappings of bureaucracy and the corruption of power and public choice and all that. When we're talking about, you know, say an EPA or FDA bureaucrat, you know, pushing papers, like we don't want to give that person too much power. You know, they're self-interested. They're not doing things for the public good necessarily. But, you know, you take a guy out of high school and you give him, you know, 6 weeks of academy training and a badge and a gun and the power to kill people, and all of a sudden the right and a good part of the middle thinks we should never second-guess that person and they should have, you know, complete autonomy, and you know, that person's decisions are always going to be in the public good and not in his own good. So, you know, I'm not anti-cop. I think we need police, but I do think they need oversight. They're subject to the same trappings of power than any other government employee is. You know, the police unions are incredibly powerful, probably the most powerful public union of any kind, actually, today. They enforce the blue code of silence where, you know, cops never rat each other out. But the other thing the police unions do that I think is particularly pernicious is that, you know, and this is true of a lot of public unions, but when a mayor or city council is negotiating with a police union, first, it's not a real, it's not a traditional management labor negotiation, right? I mean, there's really no incentive at all for a public official to take, you know, to ask police to be more accountable. I mean, the risk is actually looking anti-cop, not going the other way. So already the negotiation is sort of lopsided. But then when you throw in limited budgets, I mean, that's the one thing, if your city's running a deficit, that's the one thing you can't give a police union is better, higher salaries or better pay or whatever. So what you do is you capitulate on other things, like you make it harder to fire cops. You give them more job protections when they screw up. You give them about two dozen states now have what they call police officers' bill of rights, which are these extra protections that cops get when they're accused of crimes that regular people don't get. So I think the police unions are also part of it. I think we should do everything we can to protect the safety of cops, but not at the expense of the rights and the safety of the public. And I think I interviewed a lot of cops for this book, particularly older cops who are concerned about this. Neil Franklin, a former drug cop and state trooper in Maryland, made this point pretty eloquently. I think he said, it used to be when cops signed up for the job, you signed up for the job knowing that you were assuming a certain amount of risk and that you were voluntarily taking on that risk as sort of, out of civic duty, right? And he said cops today think that basically that they shouldn't have any risk with the job, we should protect them to the point where they're projecting that risk back onto the public. And you see this, I write a lot about the cops killing dogs phenomenon, right? And I mean, you see this mentality where a police officer and this department always backs him up on this, where, if he faced even the slightest risk of a dog's tooth piercing his skin, right, a flesh wound, basically, right, that justifies using lethal force, filling the dog with bullets. This has happened on crowded streets where bullets have struck other people, but they've struck other officers, actually. It's this idea that officer safety is so paramount that kind of force is appropriate even to prevent, a flesh wound from a dog. And, some of these dogs, I've written about cops who shot Chihuahuas and Jack Russell Terriers. On top of that, the departments don't give them any training on how to deal with dogs, right? So the threat is the perception of threat is subjective. All a cop has to say is, I feared for my safety, and whether that fear was rational or not doesn't matter. Because they don't get any training. I think police officers we've let them kind of get to this point where, one, they have this kind of shield that protects them from nearly everything. They have qualified immunity again, which, makes it almost impossible to sue them. The unions, the political protections, and a lot of this stuff can be undone, but, it'll take a lot of political will, which I think is the problem. That was a long answer. Scott.
You've written a lot about very frightening articles about prosecutorial misconduct.
Yep.
How does that intersect with the militarization of police, and if so, how so?
I think it intersects just in that it's this added protection for law enforcement. So cops get qualified immunity, which means if you want to sue a police officer for violating your rights, you not only have to show that they violated your rights, you have to show that they violated your rights knowingly, first of all. So the act has to be willing. So negligence isn't enough. So a cop raids your house and kills your dog and, paralyzes your sister. Sorry, Katie. And it was because of negligence, because they wrote the wrong address down on the search warrant. That you can't get into court for that. You have to show that it was willful. But you also have to show that the rights they violated were well established, and that a reasonable person would know that they were rights that were protected at the time. And basically what this does is it gives police officers a higher level of protection than anybody else gets. So if you run a construction site, for example, you have to know all the latest case law when it comes to liability with construction. And if you violate, if somebody gets hurt because you didn't do something that a court said you're supposed to do, you get sued. For police officers, it's not enough. If the Supreme Court comes with a decision that says this is a violation of constitutional rights tomorrow, and a cop does that to you tomorrow after that decision, he's probably not going to be held liable. You're not even going to get into it in front of a jury because the right has to be well established. So basically the right has to be on the books for 5, 6, 7 years. And if you think about actually what that does, it actually provides an incentive for police officers and police departments to not keep up with case law. Because if they actually keep up with case law and actually teach cops what the latest case law is, then they can't argue later that they didn't know that they were violating your rights at the time. So there's actually an incentive to stay ignorant of what the latest in constitutional law is. That was a long setup to get to prosecutors, but prosecutors have absolute immunity, which means you can never sue a prosecutor. In fact, there have been cases where prosecutors have been found to have fabricated evidence that resulted in the conviction of innocent people, murder in some cases, people who served decades in prison, And the courts have found that you cannot sue the prosecutor because they have absolute immunity. Now, the reason they have it is because they say, well, you know, if we could be sued, we'd be constantly second-guessing ourselves on when we bring charges, which my response would be, yes. that's exactly the point. But for whatever reason, the court has decided they deserve absolute immunity, and it's led to all sorts of problems. I mean, if you think about it, there's all these incentives to get convictions left and right, and no incentive against going too far, or no pushback for going too far. I mean, I think prosecutors are very reluctant to ever bring charges against police officers. I mean, a few times that have happened, some of them have lost their jobs after doing so. In some cases you see, you know, where it sort of looks like they bring charges, then it looks good, and then somehow they argue one of the sloppiest cases of their career when it actually comes to the trial. And that's not to say there are good cops out there, there are good prosecutors. I'm going to write a story about a great prosecutor in Utah who is actually going after these bad cops and is paying a pretty hefty political price for it. But to answer your question, I don't really know. I mean, I definitely think that they're part of the same trend, which is this generation shift toward, you know, the only acceptable position a politician can take on crime is that we're not nearly tough enough on it. And I think that both of those are products of that. I do think the pendulum's sort of slowly swinging in the other direction. I think public perception is changing on these issues, which is one of the few notes of optimism, I guess, I can bring to you tonight. In the back there, you had your hand up for.
Yes. This is one of the most deeply personal reasons that you can just flat out say you don't have an idea, but I have a tendency to follow elections very closely. One of the elections that are currently going on is the New Jersey special Senate election, where Cory Booker is promising that when he gets to the Senate, he's going to be very tough on crime. Do you know much about his death?
No, actually, no, it's the opposite. He's actually said criminal justice reform is a central part of his campaign. He wants to decriminalize marijuana. He wants to look at repealing mandatory minimums. He's actually, it's the first time I've ever, I mean, Jim Webb raised some of these issues after he was elected, but it's the first time I can remember in a long time a Senate candidate actually promising criminal justice reform, what I would consider the good kind of reform, in the campaign. So maybe he's getting tough on crime in the sense that he's trying to get tough on the bad laws. Yeah. 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 I mean, hopefully he survives this little scandal he's going through right now, because I think, you know, a voice like that is needed probably. In the something with a stripper and Twitter. I don't know. Yeah.
Next. There seems to be no lack of protests and articles and news stories about the behavior of the police force, and it appears to be getting worse and not better. And when the police force and even quite a bit of government is above the law and not subject to the law, how do we go about trying to make changes in the system when I've even talked to local government elected officials who are in fear of going against the police, like physically
cool. So yeah, I mean, I think there are things you can do and not subject yourself to any sort of physical risk. Well, actually, maybe not. I mean, I think one thing that's really worked actually over the last probably 6 or 7 years is, you know, I don't think you can overstate how powerful it is that we all have a camera in our pocket now, and that we can instantly stream video and audio to offsite servers, so that even if they try to take your phone, you know, not only does the video survive off-site, but you also now have a video of them trying to take away your phone, which is also pretty powerful. So I do think that this, and I've seen countless examples where video has actually forced the police department to, you know, take action against an officer where they otherwise absolutely, you know, almost assuredly would never have done it. And it, you know, it not only holds the bad cops accountable when you get into that position where you can't, you know, where somebody can record one, but it also lets all the other cops know that they're, you know, at any given time, somebody may be recording them. So it's going to, I think it will encourage police to sort of be on better behavior. And I do think, I completely support, I mean, I'm generally anti-surveillance, but I do think having all cops outfitted with a lapel camera and microphone is a great idea. And in fact, there was actually just a study of a couple of police departments in Southern California. I can't remember the exact numbers, but they did it for a year. And the number of abuse of force complaints, I can't remember the exact numbers, but they were, I mean, it dropped significantly, like it was like 60% or something. and the number of actual incidents dropped also. So, I mean, it definitely works. I don't know if you remember in the stop and frisk suit, the judge suggested that NYPD cops wear these cameras. Of course, you know, New York City has surveillance cameras everywhere. I mean, Bloomberg's Big Brother, you know, on steroids. But Bloomberg's reaction to that decision was that forcing cops to wear cameras on their lapels was a violation of the civil rights of police officers. I mean, I don't even know where the hell to begin with that. It's so just, I mean, it's so illustrative of, like, how Bloomberg views the state versus the individual. I mean, it was mind-blowing to say something like that. But so I do think that's huge. You know, the other thing is, and I talk about this in the book, I mean, the book is not an anti-cop book, and I don't consider myself anti-cop. Again, I think we need police officers. But, I mean, this everything I'm talking about tonight is the result of bad policy, right? You can recruit the best sort of candidates, the most well-minded, well-intentioned people, you know, prospective police officers you can find on the planet. But if you feed them into a system that's loaded with bad policy and bad incentives, you're going to continue to get bad results. Because the good people are going to quit, or they're going to turn bad, or they're going to be miserable at their jobs and really, you know, have no influence at all. So, you know, we can rail against cops and throw out, you know, all the pork-related insults we want, but, you know, the policy is really where it's at. And, you know, I think it's the sort of cowardly politicians who have, you know, played the public fear of crime and really exploited it to get elected. I mean, that, I think, is where, you know, our invective needs to go. And, you know, politicians can change the policy without sort of holding, you know, going after individual cops. So I really think, and it doesn't even, as I said, I think public opinion is shifting in the right direction, but it's not really enough to give politicians cover to do the right thing, because politicians are notoriously spineless and risk averse, and they're not, you know, they've been programmed, always, you know, look pro-police, always look pro-police, always look anti-crime. So I think it has to get to the point where not doing the right thing becomes a political liability for them. And so I think, I mean, you know, people who care about this stuff need to start voting on it, and they need to let people know that they're voting on it. You know, I think prosecutors get reelected, I think it's about 90-95% when they run for reelection. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, nobody should be, Congress is right up there too. But, you know, I think people need to start paying attention to prosecutors' records and sheriff's records. Sheriffs are elected, police chiefs tend to be appointed, but I think policy and politicians are where the change is going to happen. I don't think just sort of getting angry at cops is really going to do much good. Yes?
Have you ever suffered any personal blowback for your
space? Let me get that question. Have I suffered any personal blowback or consequences? There's only one incident I can think of. It was when I lived in suburbs of Washington. I wrote a series of articles about how the police departments in Virginia has some pretty good open records laws, but the police departments in Northern Virginia, for whatever reason, had decided to interpret those laws as giving them permission to deny every open records request. So it got to the point where, like, we would submit open records requests asking for information that they had just put out in a press release the week earlier, and they would still turn us down. So I wrote a series of articles about how absurd this was. And there were several shootings, and the police department would not release the name of the cop who shot someone. And basically, you know, as a journalist, you know, that means I can't go back and find out if this cop has had any other problems, if there's a pattern here. I mean, basically the police were saying, we're investigating internally, just trust us, right? And of course, you know, as a journalist and libertarian, like, there's nothing more offensive to me that a political official can say.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, so anyways, I wrote a series of articles about it, and it was right before I moved from D.C. to Nashville. And it was about a week after I moved to Nashville, I get an email from my former neighbor who said that a Alexandria, Virginia Sheriff's Department deputy had come up to my old house in uniform, pulled up in his car, and knocked on the door, and I guess scared the hell out of the new tenant, basically demanding to know, had my articles in his hand, demanding to know if anybody from Reason Magazine worked there. Now, I don't know. I mean, I guess he could have been there to give me a tip, but, you know, I don't know. I don't think you show up in uniform when you're giving a journalist a tip. So that seemed clearly intimidation. And, of course, I mean, I moved halfway across the country by that time, but it's still, you know, a little unnerving. But other than that, I've never really had any. I had good and bad experiences with cops, probably like anybody, but nothing's, like, directly related to my work other than that one incident.
We have time for one more question.
Sure. In the back.
Can you talk a little bit more about the capitalization of police work? I mean, the civil forfeiture and the money that they get from the feds.
Yeah.
It seems like there would be a lot more incentive to do the kind of jobs that would actually generate income mean, what kind of effect has that had on the other work, other police work?
Well, I mean, the thing about forfeiture laws is that drug enforcement is the easiest way to use the forfeiture laws, because it's very, I mean, if you find drugs in somebody's house, you can, you know, very easily make the kind of loose connection you need to make that then forces them to prove their innocence. You know, you're seeing forfeiture used a lot more. I know California now is trying to use it to confiscate the cars of Johns who are caught trying to solicit prostitutes. There's some cases where, you know, the wife owned the car and the husband was out soliciting the prostitute and the police take the car. And that's being challenged on several constitutional grounds. But DUI, you see it, they're trying to use forfeiture there. You know, I mean, the original forfeiture laws were designed to go after the mob. And it wasn't until the 80s that all of a sudden they discovered, hey, you know, we can give this money. And that money would go to the government. It wouldn't go back to the investigating police agencies. And during the 80s, it was actually Rudy Giuliani was working for the DOJ at the time and came up with this brilliant idea of, hey, if we give the actual police departments the money that they seize, that gives them a stronger incentive to, you know, do more drug investigations. And, it worked like a charm. I mean, the really screwed up thing about forfeiture, I mean, some states have actually tried to address this, and Indiana is one of them, actually. They passed laws saying that the forfeiture money has to go to a school's fund or a general fund, and it can't go back to the police department, sort of understanding the incentive problems. And first, they find a way around that, like they've done in Indiana. And Indiana actually is particularly screwed up. They actually contract forfeiture cases out to private law firms who then get a cut of whatever they can win in court. But in the states that actually have passed good laws and laws that, you know, have teeth, the federal government has then passed a superseding law that says, they call it adoption, and basically what happens is if your police agency is investigating a drug, suspected drug crime where you think there's going to be lucrative forfeiture, you call up your local DEA office, they send one agent along, you know, on the raid or to participate in the arrest. Now it becomes a federal investigation governed by federal law. Which, you know, has more lax forfeiture rules than whatever state you're in. Federal government then takes the bounty, they take 20%, and then they give 80% back to the local police agency. So they're basically just getting around the will of the state legislatures. I mean, forfeiture, it is so unbelievably outrageous the way forfeiture works. I mean, the Institute for Justice, the libertarian law firm in D.C., takes a lot of these cases. They just took one in Michigan. It's this grocery store, this mom-and-pop-owned grocery store. The grocery store had an insurance policy on cash in the store. Basically, the insurance policy only covered up to $10,000. So if they got robbed, they could get reimbursed for $10,000 in cash that they had in the store. So they were depositing less than $10,000 in their bank account, from day to day or every other day or whatever. Well, under federal law, if you deposit more than $10,000, the bank has to report that transaction to the federal government. And these are basically drug laws to prevent money laundering. And if the government thinks that you are intentionally depositing less than $10,000 in order to get around that reporting requirement, it's a felony. It's called structuring, and they'll charge you with a federal felony for the way you're depositing money. So this grocery store was depositing the money they were because the insurance policy. I mean, there's no evidence. And the government admits they have no evidence there's any drug activity going on whatsoever. But they cleaned out $35,000 from this grocery store's bank account because of the structuring law. And the thing is, they never have to actually charge them with a crime. Now these people have to go to court and prove basically that there were innocent reasons why they were depositing less than $10,000. Now, they have the insurance policy, and, you know, that'll probably help and they'll probably win, but, you know, it's going to cost them probably $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 to go to court and win this back, and then you don't get reimbursed for that. And if you're poor, you don't get in a court appointed attorney because these are civil actions, not criminal actions. Forfeiture is so screwed up, it's hard to even... And I think a lot of people don't understand just how unbelievably screwed up it is. I don't know if I really answered your question. But. All right, I guess we're done.